Don't panic. Don't panic. Don't panic.
Despite the seeming solidity and immobility of Kosciusko, the ship had never been really immobile. All ships moved all the time, and she was no more likely to lose her grip and fall off when it was under drive than when it was moved only by the old law of physics. Kos wasn't a warship. It couldn't develop the acceleration of the most anemic civilian cargo vessel on in-system drive.
Lieutenant, I don't suppose you know whether the FTL drive is irretrievably broken.
The FTL drive.
At once, she knew what the Blood Horde was going to do, and kicked herself mentally for not seeing it before. Of course they were going to take their prize away from the possible rescue before trying to open it, like a jay with a sweet nut.
No, sir. Drives and maneuvers seemed to think it was most likely sabotage, but the sequence jumps out could have knocked something loose.
Those escorts ought to be doing something useful, like blowing us away when they see us moving under power.
Esme had forgotten about the escorts, too. Her mouth went dry. Here she was, clinging to the outside of a spaceship under power, which was likely to come under fire. Her EVA suit felt about as protective as facial tissue.
Unless our crew's doing it and they're talking to them, I suppose they could be moving away from the jump point and closer to the escorts.
No. Looks to me like we're heading for it, but on a different vector. Without the nav computer, I can't be sure, but didn't this jump point have four outbound vectors?
Yes. I can't judge the approach, but you're probably right, Lynn. We're less than a half hour from jump, I'd guess, and a lot more than a half hour from any place we can get into the ship. It should be interesting. Pity we have no way to record the experience of the first people to die going through unprotected jump.
The commando survived?
Silence followed. Esme assumed the others were watching the wheeling star field that proved Kos was moving under power.
They were in Wraith.
But there was a hull breach and forward shield failure. There's nothing wrong with Kos's FTL shields.
Sweeza didn't know anything about shield technology, except that all FTL-capable ships had FTL shields.
If we get off this thing and down onto the hull...
Good idea, Sweeza.
It took almost the entire half hour to clamber down, carefully clipping and unclipping and reclipping safety lines from the high, smooth arch of the materials transport track to the hull. Here, for the first time, Esme could feel through her boot soles a faint lateral tug, another proof that Kos was moving on her own, arguing with the inertia of her former path. They were perhaps two-thirds of the way across the bridge dome from the Special Materials Fabrication Unit, its bulge hiding from them T1 and all but the tip of Specmat. Suddenly, light behind them, a flare that spread into a glow overhead. Esme ducked instinctively and looked up. The materials transport track flared into blinding vapor at its highest point and shed flaming pieces that streamed along a track, revealing their progress.
Let's see. Now we're on the outside of a ship headed for jump and someone's shooting at us. I wonder where the Adventure Cube camera crew is.
On the other escort, of course. That's why they're not shooting at us yet.
I would wonder what else could go wrong, but I don't want to give the universe ideas.
Light flared again, and this time the haze thickened. The rest of the transport track peeled away.
Good tracking, but they'll burn up the power supply if they don't let it go.
Abrupt darkness. Esme blinked, and the stars showed again.
Doing all right, Lieutenant?
Fine, sir. Just trying to remember if there's an airlock access around here somewhere.
Because even if they could survive jump on the outside of the ship, they'd run out of air before they finished. Even a short jump lasted days longer than the air supply in an EVA suit.
That's an idea. Get back in and go for them?
No, sir. Not just the four of us, with only four light weapons. I was thinking just stay in the airlock with the outer hatch cracked so no one can get in it from the inside until we drop out of the jump, then go on.
Might work. We can use suit.
Kosciusko bulled its way into the jump transition with an uncanny slithering lurch and a vibration that ground its way through Esme's boots into her sinuses. The stars were gone. She could see nothing beyond the readouts in her helmet, and they looked very strange indeed. Her calm was silent, as dark a silence as the visible dark around her. The vibration was unhealthy for the ship, for the connection of wing to core, for the stability of the drives themselves. If the drives failed, if they dropped out of FTL at some unmapped point. She clung to her handholds. She had never been that good in theory, and she knew little about FTL flight. except that there was no way to define where and when ships were when they vanished from one jump point and reappeared later, if there had been such a thing as absolute time, which there wasn't. The onboard reckoning might be anywhere from hours to days to, for the longest flight ever recorded, a quarter standard year. Onboard, inside the hull and the FTL shielding, the clocks worked. But the suit timekeeper wasn't keeping time, which meant it wasn't logging the oxygen she breathed, which meant she could run out without even knowing it.
Is it better to know when your oxygen runs out?
Esme shied away from that to a consideration of the suitcom failure. Lights and comm worked fine inside ships in FTL flight. Why not here, if they were inside the shields?
If we aren't inside the shields...
Esme's mind put the sounds together like pieces of a puzzle. It could have been a word slowed down. She nudged the suit controls, damping the sound. At least that worked. But if the suit comms didn't work, they could all get lost. Something bumped the back of her helmet. She turned cautiously. It had to be one of the others. It bumped again.
Radios don't work. Have to touch heads. Who can?
Seska tapped her arm, and she remembered her safety line. Esme switched on her helmet light and watched in amazement as the light reached slowly, slowly, down like the extrusion of a semi-solid adhesive from its tube. When it reached the hull, the edges of the shape it made rippled uneasily, the edges a moiré pattern of odd colors. Unfortunately, it illuminated no helpful markers, nothing to suggest which way an airlock might be.
Suiza!
If the light moved slowly, so might calm, the radio waves distorted by whatever the FTL drive did to space and time. Esme had a sense of waking up from some kindred slowness, as if part of her body were keyed to the velocity of light itself and lagged far behind them.
Here!
She dipped her head. The bar of light from her helmet bent slowly, undulating with the movement. She handed the end of her line to the gloved hand that appeared in the light.
I know someone who would take one look at that and spend the next month in a math trance trying to explain it.
Freeze linked. Bow relinked.
Airlock. Clock's not working.
Of course they had figured out the implications of that for themselves. Where was the nearest airlock? She stared into the darkness, trying to picture this part of the ship, to build up the model from her first days aboard when she studied COS. There was an airlock for the emergency evacuation of bridge crew at the base of the dome across from T1, which meant on their present path and perhaps a quarter hour's careful traverse. In the dark, she was not sure what their former path had been, but the leakage of the gravity unit helped her find downslope.
Follow me!
Suiza pointed her helmet downslope. The light beam bent, kinked like water from a moving hose, and rippled off in the approximate direction. Esme started after it, uneasily aware that she could catch up with her own light source. Just like the idiot captains they taught about in the academy, who had micro-jumped their ships out in front of their own beam weapons and fried themselves. She glanced sideways without moving her head, and saw other streams of light like her own, but slightly different in color. Felt a touch on her back.
We'll follow you. Stay in direct contact.
She felt her way cautiously from one grabbable protuberance to another. It was like climbing boulders in the dark, which she'd done only that one time because it was such a stupid way to get hurt, hanging out over a dark place, feeling for nubs and not knowing how far down. Here, down was a meaningless concept, and she had no idea what would happen if she lost contact with the hull. There was no sensation of external pressure, as there would be from speed in an atmosphere with wind battering. No, but from deep inside came another pressure, as one body cavity after another insisted that things were wrong, were bad, and shouldn't be moving this way. The worst of the vibration had evened out. It should have been better. Instead, she felt growing pressure in her skull. She could feel the roots of her teeth tickling her sinuses. Her eyes wanted to pop out to escape the swelling. She paused as she felt a tug on the line connecting her to the others.
I think maybe we're not inside the FTL shielding. Just the collision shields.
Esme's memory unreeled the correct reference this time, showing the FTL shield generators affecting a network of spacers set just under the hull covering. Of course, the outer hull could not be shielded from FTL influences. It had to travel there. It was hard not to overrun her light, but she finally figured out just how to position her head and move so that she could see possible handholds and clip joints coming up just out of reach. She passed a communications array and remembered that it was only a few meters from the airlock entrance. But which way? And exactly how many? She paused there, wrapped her line around the base of the array, not stopping to wonder why it hadn't snapped off when they went through the jump point.
It's nearby. Wait, I'm going to look.
Shine in different directions. Might help.
It would. She watched as the two beams she could see looped out on either side of hers. She gave herself 5 or 6 meters of line and scooted out to the end of it, then began circling. The airlock, when she found it, had a viewport beside the control panel. She clipped into the bar meant for that purpose, peeked through, and saw only more dark. She didn't want to try turning on the interior lights. Why announce to the Blood Horde commandos where they were? Esme tugged a signal on her line and wrestled with the control panel as she waited for the others to catch up. She had trouble making her light stay on the controls while she tried to operate them. The safety panel slid at last, and she looked at the directions. It had been designed for emergency exit, not entrance. So the entrance instructions were full of cautions and sequences intended to keep some idiot from blowing the pressure in neighboring compartments. She punched the sequence that should work. Nothing happened. She looked at the instructions again. First, lock the inner hatch, the button marked inner hatch, then the close switch. Then check the pressurization, test pressure. She went that far, then read and completed the rest of the sequence. But the lights did not turn green, and the airlock did not open.
Does it have a manual override?
Didn't find one. I tried the auto sequence twice.
Esme moved aside. Freeze found the override beneath a separate cover panel with its own instructions. It was mechanical, requiring a hard shove clockwise, which freed a set of dials that had to be rotated into the number sequence printed on the inside of the cover. Seska and Freeze struggled with the lever. She could imagine what they were saying. Fighting with the lever would use oxygen fast. Esme stared at the instructions for the automatic sequence, wondering why it wasn't working. Lock in her hatch, test pressurization, enter number of personnel coming in, key in opening sequence for outer lock. She'd done that. She went on reading, past the warnings against unauthorized use, down to the fine print, hoping to find something she'd missed that would get it open. In that fine print, down at the bottom, the final word was, "Note, external airlocks cannot be used during FTL flight." In even finer print, "The constraint poses no risk to personnel, as personnel are not engaged in EVA activities during FTL flight." Esme leaned over and put her helmet against Seska's.
Some fool must have painted this thing shut.
No, it won't work in FTL flight. It says that at the bottom.
The others stopped struggling. Freeze leaned into her helmet.
So it does, on this panel too. Says we don't need it because, of course, we aren't out here in FTL. Silly us, being impossible.
Wish they were right. All right, Sweeza, now what?
Esme opened her mouth to protest that. They outranked her. They were supposed to make the decisions. And shut it again, thinking. The oxygen running out at a rate they could not determine. Time passing. Somewhere, at least, inside the ship, time was passing. Could they make it to their original goal before the oxygen ran out? Could they get in if they did? If all the airlocks were inoperable in FTL flight, they could at least use the air outlets in the repair bays, if those worked. Then it occurred to her that maybe this airlock had an external oxygen feed, too. Some airlocks did, for the use of personnel stacked up waiting to use the lock. She turned back to the control panel and looked. There. Traditional green nipple fitting, though only one at this lock. Unless it, too, automatically shut off because no one would use it during FTL flight. Esme tapped Bowery next to her on the shoulder. He looked, nodded, and turned. She found the recharge hose on the back of his suit and unclipped it for him. The oxygen flow light came on when he plugged in, so at least the ship's system thought it was supplying oxygen.
Gauge still stuck.
Which was going to make it hard, if not impossible, to figure out when the suit tanks were recharged.
Counting pulse. Don't interrupt.
Esme had no faith that her own pulse was anything like normal, nor did she know how long it would take to replace an unknown consumption, even if she could use her pulse to determine duration. They crouched what seemed like a long time in silence until Bolri unplugged from the access.
There. Should do it. Your turn. If you know your heart rate, give it 3 minutes. Otherwise, I can count for you.
Others first. They were wrestling with that lever.
Don't be too noble, Lieutenant. We might think you were bucking for promotion.
Seska moved over and plugged in, then Freeze, and finally Esme.
Why 3 minutes? Because I've got a test that doesn't depend on the suit's internal clock. We'll need more, but I figured 3 minutes would give us a margin of 15 at least. My suit stopped registering at 1 hour, 58.3 minutes. Is that in the range for the rest of you?
It was. Esme counted not her pulse, but seconds.
Aha!
It works?
I think so. It would help if we could rig up some way of getting us all hooked up at once, though, because calculating the differentials for the waiting periods is a bit tricky.
Give us an estimate. It'd take too long. We don't have tools.
All right. Sweeza, you're still hooked up. You'll need the longest time on. Then it goes down. I'll count it off for you.
Esme wondered what kind of gauge Bolri thought he'd worked out and how long it was going to be, but she didn't want to interrupt his count. She felt vaguely silly hanging there in the dark and silence, waiting to be told it was time to unhook herself from the oxygen supply, but tried to tell herself it was better than being dead.
Time's up. Next.
When they had all tanked up by Bolri's count, which Esme could only hope bore some relation to reality, they still had to decide what to do next.
Sweeza, do you know where all the airlocks are?
I studied it for Major Patak's exam when I first came aboard, but I don't really know. There are some I do remember. On each deck, between T3 and T4, for instance. Once you're on T3, there are airlocks both inside the repair bay and opening on the outer face toward T4.
We could just stay here. We know where this oxygen is.
If we knew how long the jump transit was. If it's anything more than a day or so, we've got other suit limitations.
I don't suppose you know a handy external source of snacks, water, and power packs.
And toilets?
Sorry, I believe all those substances are restricted to the interior of the ship during FTL flight.
Then we'd better head toward the next oxygen access and hope that we find a way inside before we have to.
Navigation was going to be their worst problem. Although Kos's hull was studded with more protuberances than Esme had expected, it was still mostly matte black and unmarked. Creeping, feeling her way across that great black expanse, she felt like a deep-sea creature, one of those her aunt had shown her pictures of. An abrupt change in the topography she could see signaled the drop-off, as it were, into the gulf between T3 and T4. Esme struggled to think which direction to move next.
Down toward the lower decks in the crease between T3 and the core? Along the top of T3?
She didn't even know if the great clamshell gantry supports were closed around Wraith, or if they'd gone into jump with the repair bay open to the dark. As if in answer to her question, light reappeared in the outer dark. At least, she supposed it was light, because her eyes reacted to it, and her brain, trying to make what she saw into the shapes she expected. It looked strange, and more like pale smoke blowing than light, thick streams fraying to looser strands as she watched. But it gave an impression of some angular bulk just off to her left, with towering plumes above. Far away, a tumbled trail of light, a badly plowed furrow, receded redly into the distance. They all paused and moved into the helmet-touching huddle.
If I were a physicist, I just might go crazy. Most of what we've seen since jump hasn't fit most of what I've learned about FTL flight. But since I'm a mere ship's captain, I say it's beautiful.
The gantries are up. Repair base unsealed. If it doesn't have some kind of barrier I don't know about, we should be able to get in that way.
Why'd they turn the lights on now?
Just got the separate power supply hooked up. The Bloodhorde's got the bridge. They probably cut power to the wings, maybe even life support. But each wing actually has its own ship support capability.
So we just walk over and hop down one of those openings?
Only if we want to hit 16 or 17 decks down after a 1G acceleration. We might be able to climb down the gantry legs.
Esme had never actually been on the gantries, but she'd seen others up there. The problem was, would their friends shoot them first or give them time to explain who they were?
Our suit comms should work in there, and maybe they won't see us right away.
The walk along the topside of T3 to the first of the openings was easier than the final traverse of the dome, but fraught with its own difficulties. The unhappy light streaming away from the openings illuminated nothing in their path, and a lot was in their path. The sheared roots of the materials transport track supports, cables set to brace the clamshells, counterweights for the mechanisms that raised and lowered them. At least something was always near at hand to clip the lines to. The personnel lift shaft was where Esme had remembered it should be. Far, far below, its controls locked down. She could see a section of Wraith with her skin off and a crowd of workers in EVA gear clustered around a bundle of crystals that ran out of sight fore and aft. There was at least the comfort of a niche below the hull line, a platform large enough for 20 or more workers to stand waiting for the personnel lift. Esme started down the 10 mesh steps that led down to it. On the second step, ship's gravity caught her feet.
Oh!
She felt glued to the step. By the time she got to the platform, she felt the drag of gravity through every bone, but her head felt clearer. Inside, the light looked normal, if less bright than usual. She glanced around. Only some of the lights were on, spotlighting the workers. Of course, on internal power, they'd conserve where they could. The others came down, one by one, carefully. None spoke until they reached the platform. Esme glanced around. Oxy supply lines in the bulkhead. A real bulkhead, with the green triangle for oxygen access painted on it. A water tap. Even a suit relief valve. Suit maintenance really hated people who turned in soiled suits. A movement in her helmet caught her attention. Her suit's internal clock was working again, and the oxygen gauge squirted up, then dropped, then rose again slowly to indicate that she had 35% of her supply left, 1 hour and 18 minutes at current usage. She started to speak, then realized that if the suit comms were working properly, they could be overheard. And why wasn't she hearing the others? Different circuits? She found the controls in her suit and switched around the dial.
Give me one. Just one. Now a half.
Back to the other channel, the one they'd used into the jump into FTL.
They're on a different setting. At least some of them are.
Seska peered over the rail at his ship.
Makes sense. How do we get down?
Freeze eyed the emergency ladder, which led down to the first horizontal gangway on this side of the repair bay, 5 decks below.
Carefully. If we try to get the lift up, they'll know we're here.
Better report now. If we hail them on their own frequency, it might be someone I know. They can get Major Patak to identify me anyway.
You're right, but in the grand tradition, it seems a bit tame to let them know. Adventurers who've survived unprotected FTL flight ought to do something more dramatic. Why weren't we provided with those little invisible wire things that spies and thieves are always using to lower themselves from the heights?
Blame the props department.
Sweeza, if you ever get tired of maintenance, I'd be glad to have you on my ship. I wondered at first, but now I can see why the Admiral wanted you on the operational end of this.
Thank you, sir. Now I'll just let them know we're here.
Esme switched channels, hoping she wasn't cutting across another transmission.
Now back, 10th. Just right there.
Lieutenant Sweeza here.
What? Who? Where are you?
I'm up at the top of the bay, on the personnel platform, by Lift 1, with 3 other officers. Captain Seska and Lieutenant Commander Freeze of Wraith, and Commander Bowery from the schools. I have an urgent message from Admiral Dossignol for the senior officer in T3.
Commander Jarls, head of inventory control, was the senior commander aboard T3. Esme had met him briefly at one of the officers' socials, but didn't know him well. Now he was angry, his stocky body thrust forward in his chair, his cheeks flushed.
What did you think you were doing, hiding up in the rafters all this time? I was told you were going over to T1 to some kind of conference with the Admiral and Commander Ceviche and other important brass.
I did, sir.
And with everything else going on, you just lazed your way the long way around? You can't tell me you got past the blast doors or that you didn't hear the all call telling everyone in this wing to get their tails to assembly points.
Esme interpreted the emphasis on important brass to mean that Commander Jarls of Inventory Control had had his nose put out of joint because he wasn't invited to that conference. Now he was feeling very much on his dignity.
Sir, if I may ask, how is communication with the rest of the ship, especially T1?
We've got a link to T4 thanks to the access tunnel, but no one else. Why?
Then you might not be aware that the captain was gassed and in critical condition. Admiral Dossignol was injured in a firefight, and that's why the Admiral didn't come along. I have his orders here.
Esme fished them out of her pocket and handed them over. Jarls pursed his lips and gave her a nod that clearly meant, tell the rest.
We couldn't get past the blast doors out of T1. The captain gave us the override codes, but they didn't work. The Admirals felt it was imperative to get Captain Seska and his exec back to Wraith. The reasoning's in that order cube, sir. So we got out to the Specmat Fab far end and followed the transport track partway over the ship.
You crossed the whole ship?
Yes, sir. I don't know if the scans here picked it up, but the ship took hostile fire from beam weapons. The shields held, but the transport track was destroyed.
She waited a moment for any questions, then sprang the big one.
Then it went into jump. That's why it took us so long to get back.
You're telling me you were on the outside of this ship during jump insertion?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant, you're either crazy or lucky or blessed by some combination of deities I have never heard of. The officers with you confirm this story?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I presume you need a little time to eat or something. We've got a scratch mess set up. My clerk will direct you. Give me time to read these orders, and then I'll want a complete report down to each breath you took, and from the others as well. You can have, what, an hour?
Patak was waiting for her outside.
Where have you been?
Crossing the outside of the ship during the fighting, the jump, and FTL flight. Thanks, by the way, to whoever turned on the repair bay lights. We're having problems up until then.
Well, somehow I suspect I'm losing you permanently for hull and architecture. I'll take you down for what passes for food. Where's the Admiral?
In T1, as far as I know. He was hurt but alive. The captain was gassed and may be dying when we left.
And here we are, hijacked like a fat-bellied traitor, going someplace we don't know and into trouble we can only imagine. Much good our escorts did us.
Esme found a toilet, then food. Basic mush, but it was hot, and the temporary cook had spiced it with something that gave it an actual flavor. She had expected to feel better after eating, but the warmth in her belly made her sleepy instead. She felt she could sleep standing up, and maybe even walking. It made no sense. She woke with her cheek on the table. Major Patak was a few feet away, talking on the comm. Esme struggled to get her head up as Patak came back.
I talked to Commander Jarls, and he said, what with the jump and all, he'll need longer to assess the Admiral's orders. You're going down for half a shift, at least.
Esme would have argued, but when she pushed herself up, her head swam. Patak found her an empty space in a nearby corridor, in a row of other sleeping forms, and before she knew it, Esme was asleep on the hard deck. No dreams troubled that sleep, and she woke clear-headed. She made her way around the other sleepers, found a working toilet and shower. It was hard to believe that with all the emergencies, they still had enough extra water to use for showering, but she needed it. Then she went back to Commander Jarls's office, where she found Commander Bolry dictating his own report of their experiences. He grinned at her, but kept talking.
Then the lights came on, which made it easier to find our way to T3 and the overhead access. Whatever those openings are really called. Anyway, once back inside the ship, we found normal gravity and our suit instruments began working again.
Bowery turned off the recorder.
Did you fall in a heap too? I did. And I've just talked to Seska and Freeze aboard Wraith. They said they'd barely gotten aboard when they couldn't stay awake. Scared the hell out of their crew.
Maybe it was being outside the FTL shields.
Maybe. Maybe it was having had a long and interesting day. You know, you're really good at this kind of stuff. How'd you get stuck in a DSR, if you don't mind me asking?
That mutiny, probably. I guess they didn't want any of those involved where they'd get into similar trouble. And since I ended up commanding, they sent me as far away as possible.
Where you promptly found a use for your newly acquired expertise. Yeah. They might as well put you back on command track. You're a lightning rod.
I was a technical track before that. Scan.
You? Your advisor messed up. You're a natural, and I don't say that lightly. Put in for transfer.
That's what my boss here said once. Major Patak, in Hull and Architecture.
Believe it.
She almost did. From someone like this, a seasoned veteran who had observed her, maybe it was true. And maybe she wasn't just lucky, but good at it. Commander Jarls came out of his inner office.
Lieutenant Sweeza, I'm glad you're here. I hope you're rested, both of you. Captain Seska says he's staying aboard Wraith, but Lieutenant Commander Freeze is coming to liaise with us on a plan to retake the Kosciuszko and fight off any attempted boarding. Lieutenant Sweeza, Admiral Dossignol seems to have a lot of faith in you.
Considering that she saved the captain's life, and later the Admiral's, I'd say he had reason.
I suppose.
Jarls looked down at the files in his hand.
He wanted you to take over all security for T3 and T4, and said you had helped develop a plan to trap a Blood Horde ship. Frankly, with the Admiral out of communication, I'm not comfortable putting that much responsibility on a junior officer I don't know very well. I've consulted with Major Patak, who gives you a favorable review, but I'm not sure.
Got a plan yet?
That was Freeze, smiling again after rest and food.
Captain Seska sends his regards and says he's got to guess how long we'll be in FTL flight.
He waited a moment for that to sink in, then waved a data cube.
Nothing wrong with Wraith's nav computers, though she couldn't give us any scan data. But from where we were, there are four primary mapped routes that we know, and know the Blood Horde knows. They're on all the standard references. Two we can pretty much dismiss. They won't go back where they attacked us because they can figure that our ships will be out there looking for them. In the same way, they won't backjump where you came from because they don't know if there were more fleet ships there. But there's Cascadian, which has a direct route into Blood Horde space at Hawkhead, and Volander, which is offset to most routes and a long jump to Blood Horde space, but direct and a long way from any fleet pickets.
Put it up on the screen.
Freeze complied, and they stared at the tangle of lines, thicker or thinner with flux values, edged with colors that told which political entities were known to use those routes.
Wraith's onboard systems say we went through the first jump point some 43 hours ago. We need someone from Drives and Maneuver to give us the figures on this ship's FTL drive, and then we might know which route we're on and when we might drop out.
How long are they for regular travel?
Cascadian should be about 122 hours, maybe longer given the slow insertion and assuming the same exit. Volander would be about 236 hours.
Long jumps. Longer than we made coming in. I'd expect them to go for the short one with so few of them aboard.
Now, on the connecting lines, how does this ship handle series jumps?
It doesn't. Or rather, in theory, it can, and we did coming out after you, but usually there's a pause of several hours for recalibration between jumps.
Besides, they'll want to get more of their people aboard. The intruders have been working as hard as we have, without relief and shorthanded.
So we've got roughly 60 hours before you think we'll come out of jump, and until then, all we have to cope with is the ones aboard?
Yes, sir.
Captain Seska wants to know how far the repairs on Wraith can get by then.
Now, we have no access to the main inventory stores, and we can't move anything from SpecMat while we're in FTL. I suppose Major Patak will know about the structural repairs.
Esme decided this was no time to tell him that nothing was going to come from SpecMat by the exterior transport system until it was rebuilt.
60 hours. Nobody can come in from outside while we're in FTL flight. And surely those Blood Horde are getting tired by now. There aren't that many. If we can get back in contact with the rest of the ship, we might be able to take control back.
And get ready for whatever's waiting when we come out of jump. If they're jumping to a place where they have a battle group waiting, how many ships would that be?
With the Blood Horde? 5 or 6, probably.
A two-part plan. Get control of this ship and defeat whatever's waiting for us.
For which we need warships. We can't mount weapons on Kosciuszko.
Who's here for weapons? I know Commander Weish is in T1.
It can't be done.
Esme looked at Jarls, then glanced at Bowery.
I think, Commander, to make best use of the resources of the 14th, the senior person in each department should assist in our planning.
For a moment, Jarls puffed around the neck, exactly like the frogs Esme remembered from home. Then he relaxed.
All right. All right.
When the fourth person started to remind the group that they couldn't do what they usually did, Esme lost patience.
Now that we know what we can't do, it's time to start thinking what we can do. 58 hours at this point. What can we do in 58 hours? Thousands of intelligent, inventive, resourceful people with the inventory we have available can come up with something.
Lieutenant.
Commander Pallas held up his hand.
I agree. We don't have time for the negatives. Do any of you know what the senior officers are planning in case of a Blood Horde assault?
Bowery outlined it quickly.
So I think that getting a Blood Horde ship into T4 would still work. Is there some way to get it sort of stuck so they can't move it? I think they'd come boiling out, and if they were somehow diverted away from it, some of our people could get in, if it could be unstuck.
Ah, there's that new adhesive. Really strong, but depolymerizes in the presence of specific frequencies of sound. We could coat the barriers.
That's what we need to hear. Now, we know we don't have that many troops capable of close contact fighting. Someone think of a way to immobilize Blood Horde troops who will be wearing EVA battle suits.
So gas won't work. If we knew the signal characteristics of the suits...
What about gluing them down?
Then our people couldn't get to the ship. The stuff stays tacky too long.
You'll think of something. Now, about getting to the rest of the ship.
And once we're out of FTL, we could rig a communications cable back around the T1.
Once we're out of FTL, the airlocks will work. And we have a lot of EVA suits. Our people work in vacuum a lot.
Then to head the team that's going to get Wraith as ready as possible to put on the drive test cradle, Major Patak, because she's hull and architecture.
I'll need to pull people from...
Go ahead. If there's a conflict, get back to me. Commander Pallas, could you head the team that will plan the capture of a Blood Horde ship, assuming we can get one into T4?
Certainly. May I ask where you'll get your crew?
That was my first assignment from Admiral Dossignol. I'll choose a crew from those who have served aboard warships fairly recently. Lieutenant Sweeza, I'd like you from my exec when the time comes. But in the meantime, I'd like you to work on the assignment Admiral Dossignol gave you. Prepare security here to defend these wings against the intruders. I suspect they'll try to get into T4 to prepare it for their own ships.
Yes, sir.
Esme wondered how she could possibly get ready for both. But having argued against negative thinking, she knew better than to say anything. Vokrace grinned happily at his pack, bloodied, bitten, but not defeated, and they had the bridge, its surviving crew demoralized and, at least temporarily, cooperative. The ship had made its jump into FTL without falling apart. The wings were locked off, helpless. Three of them had been reduced, at least largely, to unconscious dreamers and corpses. T3 and T4 so far held out. He'd expected more resistance there, but it didn't matter. When they came out of jump in a few hours, the ship pack would be waiting, with enough warriors to manage them. After all, they had no real weapons over there, and they were only mechanics and technicians anyway. His people had even gotten some rest. It didn't take the whole pack to subdue these weaklings. Three of them were sleeping now. By making the bridge crew work longer shifts, they'd kept them tired enough that there'd been no sign of rebellion. He stretched, easing his shoulders. They had done everything they'd set out to do, done it better than predictions. Their commander had not believed they'd be able to get the ship through jump. He was waiting for a message. He'd be delighted to get the whole prize. Still, he hated leaving any part of the job undone. He had missed out on 4 years of raiding. The pack had fewer ship scars than any other of their seniority. They'd paid dearly in honor and opportunity for the preparation necessary for this operation. He didn't want to share the glory with anyone. If he could offer his blood bond, the ship entire, he could raise his banner any time he chose. Independent command. He glanced around. Hoch looked bored. He had tormented the Serrano cub until all the fun was out of it. Three of his remaining pack would be enough to hold the bridge against the unarmed, spineless sheep that now sat at the controls. Excitement roiled in his gut again.
Let's do it.
His pack looked up, eager. Who should stay behind? As he described in their own tongue what they were going to do, he looked at their faces, looking for the slightest hint of weakness, exhaustion, or even worse, contentment. First, they would unlock the barriers to T4. With the crippled Wraith in T3, most of the personnel would be in T3. Could they repair Wraith in time? He doubted it, but even if they did, it could not outfight a whole ship pack. Vokrace considered which deck they should use. According to the ship maps, Deck 17 contained hydroponics and even a few small gardens tucked among the gantry supports. Unlikely anyone would be watching for them up there, and they'd have a good view of the entire repair bay. They could work their way down, using their weapons and gas grenades to subdue anyone in their way and drive them to a holding area at the base. And they had no way out. Not if he opened only the Deck 17 hatch. They'd be sure to close it behind them. Corporal Jakara Janice kept her eyes on her screens, obedient and to all appearances as scared as all the rest. She had not indulged in the sidelong glances that got Sergeant Blanders a beating. She had not struggled when one of the Blood Horde fondled her and told his friends what he planned to do with her later. Above all, she had not revealed, by the slightest change of expression, that she understood everything they said in their own language. While she could do nothing, she did nothing. But now, she thought it over, while appearing to cower away from the leader's rough, blood-stained hands.
You'll be good, won't you? You wouldn't think of giving any of us trouble.
It'll be over soon, one way or another.
She was sitting the wrong board, though the Blood Horde hadn't figured that out. They'd come in screaming and shooting, and by the time they'd done, what with bodies all over the floor and the noise everyone was making, they hadn't noticed her changing name tags with a dead woman. At that point, she wasn't sure why she'd done it. Some instinct had urged her, and when they left the communications board empty and she moved to Environmental, where Corporal Askoff usually sat, she began to think what she could do. None of her shipmates had commented, though she'd gotten some looks. But after what happened to Sergeant Blanders, they didn't look anywhere but at their own work. The Environmental Systems Board cross-linked to Ship Security, another board the Blood Horde had left empty after they changed the override codes. Possibly they didn't know that. She wouldn't have known it, sitting calm as she usually did. But she and Alice Askoff had been working the same bridge shift long enough to share details of their work. Either Security or Environmental might have reason to close off the wings from the core, or take control of life support. If they were watching too closely, as they had, with 10 of them always alert, always stalking around behind people, she could do nothing. But if they left only 3, at some point she would not be observed for a moment, and...
What would be the best thing to do? I open all the wings. Will the sleepy gas simply spread to the core and put everyone there to sleep?
The captain had gone to T1 to confer with the admirals. She knew that. She'd seen the captain on the bridge shortly before the Blood Horde commandos burst in and took over. So if the captain was still alive, he was in T1, and maybe the admirals too. If he wasn't gassed, if he wasn't dead. If you can't make up your mind, her mother always said, do something anyway. Luckily, the core environmental system needed frequent adjustment when it was cut off from the wings. She had explained this earnestly when she first needed to touch the board. The Blood Horde had leaned over, far too close for comfort, and stared at the display a long time before giving her permission to touch it. After the 10th or 11th change, they'd paid less attention, only asking now and then when the display showed a yellow band instead of green just how long she proposed to let it go. The 3 left behind would be nervous. She listened as the others left and did not turn around. Someone else did.
Get back to work!
They'll be watching, but will they understand?
A yellow flicker on her board, just as before. The core, unlike the wings, did not have a large hydroponic garden area for oxygen production and carbon dioxide uptake. Oxygen was supplied from electrolysis of the water in the Deck 1 pool, and she had to keep the hydrogen collectors from overfilling. As well, she needed to put new CO2 scrubbers online. She started to enter these commands, and as she expected, one of the 3 came up behind her.
What now?
The hydrogen, sir.
It needs a new collector unit, and I need to put another 10 CO2 packs online.
No tricks. Understand?
The muzzle of his weapon stroked her cheek. She shuddered, nodded, and her fingers trembled as she entered the values. The question now was, how long did she have, and how could she do the most the quickest? She would open the T1 access, she'd decided, but not T5, because she knew T5 had been gassed. If she had time, she'd reset the override codes for all the wings so that the captain or any of ship's security who were still alive and awake could use them.
Sir!
Admiral Levati looked up. One of the security guards stood in the doorway.
Yes? Sir, the hatches are open. We're not cut off from the core.
All the hatches, all decks?
Yes, sir. At least, that's what the system says.
Levati looked over at Dossignol, who was hunched awkwardly in his chair.
I don't think this is their doing.
No. I'd say go for the bridge, with everything we have.
They had planned an assault on the bridge, but had not been able to breach the barrier.
You can handle this end?
I can hardly run yours, having been stupid enough to get shot. Confusion to our enemies.
I attend a good deal worse than confusion.
Levati turned on his headset.
Bridge team, go ahead.
You're stupid!
Corporal Janice would have been furious with herself for not remembering that the barrier status lights showed clearly on the board if she'd been able to think. A savage kick in the ribs curled her around the pain.
Please, 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 let it work. Let someone be alive there, awake.
Now two of them were on her. One of them kicked savagely at her arms, her ribs. It hurt more than she'd expected, and more noise. She couldn't think why it would be so noisy.
If they were going to make up with you, why would they shoot you?
She hardly noticed the blows had ceased. Then it was quiet again. She wanted to flinch away, but couldn't move.
I think she's alive.
Janice opened the eye that would open and saw what she had hoped to see. Shipmates, armed, and just beyond them, a blood-horde corpse. She smiled.
They're trying to get through the barrier up on deck 17. They got the core side barrier open, but the interlock we put on the wing side barrier's holding.
Are they really committed?
Oh, it sounds like it.
Then I think it's time for Brother Ass and the Cactus Patch.
Excuse me?
Folktale from my home planet, slightly revised. As long as we provide enough resistance, they'll be sure we didn't want them there. Only we do want them there because it's our trap.
How long do we make them wait?
Long enough to...
Suiza!
Yes?
Our people have the bridge. The barriers are operable on the old override codes.
Esme swung back to her comm unit. If they knew they'd lost the bridge, they might not come into the trap.
Now. Let them in now. Be sure to lock the gate behind them once they're onto another deck.
By all combat logic, they should be hoping to clear T4 from the top down. If they found the top deck empty, they should go looking for resistance. The scan techs had installed additional surveillance near the hatch and in the passages beyond. Esme watched as the hatch slid aside. The Bloodhorde commandos still wore their fleet uniforms, now bloodstained and filthy, under light armor they'd stolen from the ship security. Helmets and respirators. They couldn't be gassed, but the respirators were noisy enough to affect their hearing. The helmets were supposed to compensate with boosted sensitivity, but that had its shortcomings. They each carried several weapons, the light arms intended to suppress shipboard violence.
They're outnumbered, but we're still outgunned.
Guns aren't the ultimate weapon.
Would they choose the well-lit passage ahead or the dim one to the left among the garden rows? They'd had only a few concussion shells taken from Wraith's damaged starboard battery, and she hadn't been able to seed every possible route. As she'd hoped, they headed down the dimmer passage. They moved as she remembered her father's troops moving, cautious but swift. It was on the basis of that trained advance that she'd planted the shells where she had, and when they passed the marked point, the shells burst around them. Esme had the sound turned down, but they hadn't. They were flat on the deck, firing at nothing, and unable to hear anything but the racket they made and their own ringing ears. She was sure of that. The top level of T4 was too big for them to check thoroughly. She had counted on that, and on their reaction to resistance. From one position to another, they followed what seemed to be a retreating force of slightly lesser strength. They would be trying to pick up its communications through their helmets. Surely they would change channels until they found it. And what they heard would sound authentic. Esme had discovered that the 14th had its own drama club, its members eager to create and record a script full of dramatic conflict. It had multiple branches, just in case the enemy didn't follow the main plot line, and one of the communications techs cued the different segments while watching the vid scan to see what the intruders were really doing. She keyed to listen herself for a moment.
Hold them at deck 15! We can hold them if they don't come down that inboard ladder! Corporal Randall, cut off that ladder!
Here's the ammo, sir, but we're running out!
Sure enough, on the vid scan, the Blood Horde had turned back, looking for and finding the inboard ladder. Poppers wired into sensors blew off as they started down. Smoke swirled. Fleet uniforms wrapped around bundles of insulation moved, fell, were dragged backwards.
Whiteout! Whiteout! They're on the ladder! Hold them!
We're trying! No! They've got Pete!
More gas masks! They're using more gas!
It would have been fun to watch, like being behind the scenes when an adventure cube was being taped, except that more than half the sites needed someone live on the scene to produce a realistic effect. The enemy didn't know which targets were live, but Esme did. She had argued at first for a less risky approach, dousing the intruders with that adhesive, if nothing else. But the capture of an enemy warship would be easier if it thought it was coming into a ship controlled by its own people. Ideally, they'd get to the base of the repair bay just as the ship came out of FTL flight. They'd find the lockers of EVA suits. They'd open the repair bay. It was all set up for automatic use, with new, and newly aged and scuffed, control panels and instructional labels. Esme switched to the secure link to the bridge. They had opened a T3 access hatch and fed an optical link through it. She knew the captain was alive but in critical condition, now in a regen tank in medical, which had been purged of the sleepy gas. The casualty count was rising as search teams found more and more bodies. Most were bodies, but a few had been wounded. Baron hadn't been found yet. A jolt, like stepping off a ledge in the dark, bumped her spine on the chair. She glanced at the clock.
An hour early?
Jump point exit. Cascadian system. Low V exit.
So they were where they'd expected to be, and in one piece. A low V exit meant scan would clear soon, and they'd know how much trouble they were in. Esme wondered what jump exit would have looked like from outside and shuddered. They could not have survived the whole trip outside, she was sure.
Prelim scan, 6. Say again, 6 Blood Horde ships. Weapons analysis follows.
Now where are the Blood Horde intruders?
Esme looked back at the vid scan, at deck 10. Too far up. She wanted them able to contact their own ships, and for that they had to be at deck 4.
Release! Release!
The communications tech nodded and switched to the final segment. Anguish, terror, harsh breathing, resistance melting away in panic. Predictably, the Blood Horde team followed, and although they came out into the repair bay control compartment with some remnant caution, they didn't hesitate long. They had made good use of their data wands. One pair went straight to the control centers, and the others to the EVA lockers. The communications tech put on the post-battle tape. If they kept listening, they'd hear individuals trying to find each other, trying to decide what to do, where to take the wounded. The two who could speak, or at least understand, the Blood Horde dialect, tuned in the output of the communications desk in the repair bay. What would they say to their ships? The Blood Horde ship looked nothing like the sleek black ovoids of the fleet.
Damn converted tramp hauler.
Esme agreed. Slightly larger than a fleet escort, and perhaps a third shorter than a patrol craft, its hull had a more angular outline suggesting its origin as a civilian freight carrier.
Part of that's bare metal.
Esme spotted the oblong patch, glinting dully in the repair bay's spotlights. The rest was probably the same organoceramic material that most ships used, its scarred, uneven coloring suggesting patches of different ages and origins. Along the flank, bright painted symbols that must mean something to the Blood Horde. Near the nose, rows of stylized eyes and jagged teeth. She shivered. The ship edged in, still untethered, but now in easy reach of the grapples. Someone nudged her. She followed the gesture to see tiny figures in EVA gear moving on the plates of Deck 1. That would be the Blood Horde intruders, come out to welcome their friends and let them aboard. One of them moved to the control board for the grapples on her side. Another stood at the controls for the other set of grapples. She could not see their hands on the controls, but she could see the result, the shift of the grapple heads as they moved into position, released from the heads and then impacted the ship. The sling buffer at the inboard end of the repair bay deployed, as if released by the grapples. They hoped the Blood Horde would think that. She watched the intruder at the grapple controls spin around and imagined his surprise. But nothing more happened. He made some hand signal to another of his team out of her sight, then turned back to the controls. The Blood Horde ship barely moved, drawn by the retracting grapples. Esme boosted the magnification on her scan and watched as the intruder pushed the grapple controls to maximum. She grinned through her tension. She'd thought they would do that. The plan would work anyway, but this was a bonus. The ship moved faster as all the grapples exerted full power. They must think the sling buffer would halt if it moved too fast, and it would, after jolting the passengers a bit. She watched in fascination as the ship moved slowly, inexorably, past the marked safety point, stretching out the grapples again, swinging like a ball on an elastic line. As if in automatic response, another buffer sling deployed, and another. The enemy ship rammed into them, nose first, stretched the first to its limit. One, two, bands ruptured and flung back across the bay.
Now, will they notice anything?
The second held, and the third barely deformed. The enemy ship shuddered, held by the buffer sling's adhesive coating and the taut grapples behind.
We did it! We got ourselves a warship!
And two problems. Take a look.
The second and third Blood Horde ships kept coming, now obviously aiming for the drive's test cradles. They should have thought of that. They'd assumed the Blood Horde would be cautious, would test with one ship until they were sure it was safe. Not their style. Of course they'd get in close with as many as possible, and with those small ships, it was not hard to maneuver in close.
Now what, genius?
Esme stared, her mind rapidly turning over the possibilities.
We won't be able to get Wraith out now. We should have done that first.
Wraith, trapped in the repair bay, immobile, capable of blowing itself, but probably not the rest. Unless its self-immolation ignited the other's weaponry, was that good enough, the best she could hope for?
No.
She wasn't playing for any outcome but victory. Her terms.
We take them both. The ones on the test cradles. Then we get Wraith out, and the other Blood Horde ship if we can. It's actually better. Evens the odds.
But we don't have crews for that many, and they're not even our ships.
After the first panic had come a surge of exhilaration. She felt as if her mind was working at double speed.
Oh, yes, we do. We have thousands of the top experts on every ship system right here, right now.
Who?
Esme waved her hand, indicating both wings.
Think about it. Do you really think our people can't figure out the controls on Blood Horde ships? They're simple. Do you think our people can't offer effective resistance to Blood Horde troops if we turn them loose? I think they can. I think they will.
They had to. And it was better. Even if they just got two, the odds were almost even.
We'll have to scramble, though, to get two... No, three crews ready to board. They'll be down in less than an hour. Well, Lieutenant, I think I'll find another exec. You're going to have to take one of those ships yourself.
The most terrifying thing about it was that she didn't feel as scared as she should be.
Right. Which one?
The T3 Cradle, because I've already got a crew assembled here. Maybe Captain Seska can free some of his crew for you.
Esme was already thinking who she wanted.
Yes, sir.
Whoever gets control of a ship first takes group command. My advice, if you're first, is to get the thing off the cradle. Don't wait for me, and fire on the first ship you can locate.
Vokrace was furious. After all they had accomplished, that pighead of a ship pack commander was going to let two more shiploads board. He knew what that would mean. They'd be claiming credit for kills he and his men had made. They'd be marking loot.
There is no need. We have the ship at our mercy. Only the troops aboard Deathblade are needed. What if the Familiar ships are following? If you take two more ships out of formation, how will you beat them off?
You assured me they could not follow, having no idea where you are.
The ship pack commander sounded entirely too complacent. When Vokrace had started this mission, the ship pack command had been promised to his own war clan. Now it had gone to the Antbird Comity, on whose graves he would spit if he got the chance. And here was another one. Not even an Antbird, but a hireling. He had met Bierling at the arena once and hadn't liked him. He wanted to slug someone, and unfortunately they'd dumped the Serrano cub for safekeeping before they came to T4.
I claim the ship. I claim the bloodshed and the riches won, the death and the treasures for the men who won them.
It's big enough to share the glory, and soon enough to divide the loot when the deed is done.
The deed is done.
You need not fear my justice. Unless you want to challenge my honor.
I do not challenge your honor. Only remember who opened this ship like an oyster.
You are not likely to let me forget. The troops in Deathblade will await the arrival of those from Antbird's Axe and Antbird's Helm before they maneuver.
In other words, Vokrace would have no chance to show the Deathblade troops, whose commander he knew well, how he had conquered. The others would overwhelm everything.
May his wife grow spines in her fur.
If only it were possible.
So we have to wait around for them all to land? Assuming those incompetents can actually land on the test cradles and get inside. Just stand here like targets?
He would not be ill-pleased if any of these people did kill us. Greedy swine. We should be extremely careful, Pack Second. There's no reason with so many eager to find loot for us to take risks.
Perhaps we might even disappear.
Not that, I think. After all, our people are in charge on the bridge. Perhaps we should go back and be sure they know who's being so helpful.
Assassination on a mission was unusual but not unheard of, and Vokrace felt in the mood to kill someone.
Let these people find their own way in. It will be good practice for them. Not all boardings are unopposed.
Esme had just made it back to T3 when she was called to one of the communications nodes.
I hear we're about to be trapped in here.
Not for long. We're going to take the ship behind you and the one coming into the T4 test cradle. As soon as we're clear, they'll warp Wraith out.
Better odds. Save me one, why don't you? I presume you'll be taking one of them yourself.
Yes, the one behind you. Commander Bowery's already got his crew over in T4.
Who's going to take the one that's docked? Or are you going to leave that one where it is?
Leave it. We don't have the crew.
And I presume you have a plan to get the test cradle on board? What if they dump their troops and take off again?
In that case, you're not blocked, and Bowery can take the ship of theirs that's in T4. But what we hear through their transmissions is that they're planning to stay a while. It's made the commander leader mad. He thinks they're stealing his glory.
Good. And good luck, Lieutenant.
Esme went back to the command center set up in the 14th's headquarters area.
I've got a list of volunteers for your crew, Lieutenant. You seem to be quite popular. They're sorted by specialty, then rank-ordered by those with experience in ships similar to the enemy's. I told them to wait for you in R-17.
That's wonderful, sir.
It was indeed. The only problem was knowing how many she should take.
We've got a link now to the other wings. One of the instructors over in Admiral Levadi's command has done a tactical analysis. He suggests...
They're going through somewhere.
They're not even off that ship yet. We've been watching.
Then it's the others. The original intruders. But why? And where?
Warn the bridge. That'll be where they're going. They may not know we've taken them back. Lieutenant Sweeza, pick your crew and get in position. I think we can ignore that tactical analysis.
Esme took the list and looked at it on her way down to R-17. Petty Major Simpkins, Drives and Maneuver, had operated the commercial equivalent of the Blood Horde hulls during the 3 years he'd tried making it in the civilian world. Two others had less, but some experience with those ships. Scan. No one had a lot of relevant experience, but there was a pivot major, Lucien Patel, that the entire remote sensing unit thought was another Kutsudis. Worth a try, anyway. For backup in scan, she picked the one person with recent combat experience, and another because he had both commercial and military background. Communications, that was critical. That one, and that one, and a backup. Environmental, she wouldn't worry about. They'd fight in their suits, and either win this in a hurry or die in a hurry. Weapons. She really needed good weapons people. There were five that seemed to stand out from the rest of the list. When she got to the meeting place, she was startled by the eagerness on their faces. They looked at her as if she could make this mad enterprise easy. She felt her own heart lift and gave them back the grin they seemed to be waiting for.
Told you, she's got a plan.
Not yet, she didn't, but she did have a crew list. She read it out, and those named came forward. Others looked disappointed. A burly sergeant, who looked vaguely familiar, stepped forward.
Can't you use a few more? If there's someone aboard, if there's a fight, I've won my share of barroom brawls.
Extras with that attitude couldn't hurt. Esme nodded, and another half-dozen clustered around. Others lingered, but didn't come forward.
The rest of you, if you haven't heard, some of the original intruders have gone back into the rest of the ship, and there are plenty of troops coming in. I'm sure you can think of something appropriate to do. The plans we had for dealing with the troops aboard one Blood Horde ship now need to work for three times that number.
The really worrisome problem was how to get to the drives test cradles unobserved. Both repair bays were now open and floodlit, so that any movement across the gap might be seen if the Blood Horde were looking for it. Even though she and Bowery both had guides, specialists who were test cradle supervisors, so that they could approach the keel of the test cradle rather than its upper deck where ships rested, they would be in sight of anyone watching from the repair bays for part of the distance. Esme did not want to trust that no one would glance over and notice a string of EVA suits going the wrong direction.
We need something else to get their attention. More smoke and mirrors. Like we used to get the intruders well into T4, but big enough to enthrall however many of them come out.
If we turned the lights out, they couldn't see you as well.
Not at first, but they probably have lights of their own. They'll be expecting something.
And we're supposed to have been partially disabled. What if our lights go off, then flicker back on? If they've got those fancy faceplates on their helmets, that'll give them fits.
I'll bet we can look really inept. Fluctuations in the artificial gravity, flickering lights. It could seem like the power's out of control.
But not until we're on our way. That means after most of them are off the test cradles. The timing's going to be tight.
Trust us, Lieutenant. We're trusting you.
Fine. I'll leave it to you then. Come on, folks. Let's get suited up and see about wiping out a Blood Horde battle group. Or whatever they call themselves.
The Blood Horde ships disgorged EVA-suited figures in clumps that reminded Esme of strings of frog spawn in the lily ponds back home. Little shiny blobs, two and three together, silvery in the light from the repair bay. They kept coming and kept coming, more than Esme would have thought would fit in such a small ship.
Do they know how visible they are?
Probably. It helps them find each other after all. Though I don't know if other ships they attack have so much light outside. It's depressing to think how visible we're going to be.
EVA suits were intended to be seen. It was a safety feature.
Too bad we didn't think to spray ourselves matte black or something.
Esme's gaze fell on the rolls of sheathing for Wraith's denuded flanks.
The skin. The sheathing. Those rolls. They wouldn't shine. If only we thought of that earlier. But now they'd see us if we tried to use them.
It's easy enough to peel off the hull. Just takes a sonic generator set at the right frequency, depolymerize the adhesive. What were you thinking, wrap it around you? It's not that flexible.
How flexible is it?
It'll make a roll about this big.
The man held out his arms.
In other words, several of us would fit into it, in our suits?
Oh, sure.
Would it be any good against scans?
Most of them, certainly. Small as you'd be.
But they had no time. It could take an hour to cut and roll enough tubes, and they didn't have an hour. Esme put that thought out of her mind.
What else might give us some cover?
Well, we can't use the high-speed sprayers in the repair bays, because they'd see it. And besides, that's part of the plan.
Esme wondered what plan, but didn't interrupt to ask.
But there's the little hand sprayers in the small parts coating work bay.
One of the EVA suit techs shot down that idea. Paint might eat through the fabric, and they had no time to experiment. So they prepared to go as they were, silvery suits and all, when one of the cook's assistants came running up with an armload of dark green waste sacks.
We look like a row of peas in a pod.
Better than silver beads. At least they're dark and not shiny.
Ahead of Esme, the base of the test cradle loomed, clearly visible in the light from the repair bay. Visible, too, was their shadow, enlarging as they neared. In its center was the little red blinking dot of the rangefinder on her helmet, giving her the distance and rate of approach.
Now.
The lights went out. She had only her helmet readout to go on, and a single chance to make any adjustments that had to be made. But presumably, the Bloodhorde attackers would be startled by the change in light. They'd be looking for people in the repair bays, where they were. Seb Caron had told her about night fighting, that no one could resist looking to see where a light had just come on or gone out. Nearer. 5 meters. 4. She pushed the makeshift control, and a little jet of gas spewed out. She felt the shove as if the ones behind her were leaning on her back. 3 meters. A very slow progression to 2, then 1. Then she tucked her head, rolled, and felt her boots thud on the hull. Her knees took up the impact easily. The base of the drive's test cradle was a maze of cables and attachments, but the test cradle supervisor they'd found knew where the nearest hatch was. Once inside, they rose through the shaft with only short tugs on the line. Then they were at the upper hatch, and Esme peered through. There was the Bloodhorde ship, an angular, dark bulk against the starfield. She couldn't tell if it was occupied, not until she had the instruments in the test cradle up and running. It was a job for the supervisor, who fumbled around for a moment. Then...
It's got active scan leaking all over it. Can't do much without them noticing. Good thing is, with them putting out that much, they're not likely to notice anything we put on the cable. Want me to signal Koss?
Yes.
In moments, the signal came back. Their arrival had been logged, and they were waiting for Bowery's report from the other test cradle. Esme reminded herself that his team had had longer to travel, that they had crossed below the line of the Bloodhorde troops coming in. Then, when she thought she couldn't wait another moment, the signal came.
Ready? Go.
This was only one tricky bit in the many tricky bits of the plan. Keeping it simple had not been an option. They needed to focus Bloodhorde attention on the repair bays, away from the assault teams who were after Bloodhorde ships. What they had to work with was more in the nature of hand-waving and colored smoke than real weaponry or the skill to use it. But to the repair crews of a DSR, hand-waving and colored smoke was second nature. Esme didn't know what they were going to do, only that it would occur in 60-second bursts of maximum distraction. They hoped.